I mean, my man was afraid to go to the rack. Like,
it's because he wasn't rocking the number 24. You know, that's why. Because he's not as much like Kobe. You know,
I will tell you one thing. He did his best Kobe impression in making these shots as difficult as possible. But Kobe was really good at converting those. And Jason Tatum was, for the most part, all series long, too, except when it came to getting to the bucket. I think he was shooting 34% around the rim, which is unbelievable for a guy who's 6'7". That's ridiculous. He should be much better than that. And it just, I don't know what happened, man. That dude just, like, was not that guy. He was not the guy that, he did not put the team on his back, though.
If he doesn't do it next year, he's never going to be it.
I just think, I mean, so I think you got to give Andrew Wiggins some serious credit, man. He played some legit defense on arguably a top 10 player. Well,
this is finally a time for, I think this is the perfect team for Wiggins to be on right now.
Because he doesn't have to be the guy.
He doesn't have to be anybody. You just be out there.
Hey, like, just come on. Play solid D. Give us just be a 17 body. To 22.
Be a body, you know? On the court right now. I got Steph. I got Clay. They know how to shoot, actually, as opposed to you, Wiggins. And I got Draymond on there who can hold down his own, who has that mentality. And it was, I think it was a nice spot for Wiggins to get into.
100%. And they made the right trade with that, getting rid of, what was his name? D'Angelo Russell. Yeah, that's a solid trade for them, you know?
Also, I want to say that I think Steph is a better playoff performer than Kobe Bryant.
What? Yeah?
I mean, he averages more points, assists, and rebounds.
Yeah, because he shoots a three like nobody's business, okay? That's why he gets all those points right now. I'm sorry.
What about the rebounds?
Kobe's got more rings. There we go. That's my winning argument right there.
We're done. Next question.
Next question.
Congratulations, Drew. You just won. It's like a Yankees fan going to the rings. It's like, well,
next question.
I mean, you might think, but I've actually won, no matter what. Kobe's got five of them.
Yeah.
So wait.
What happens when Curry gets five or six? What are you going to say then?
Die in a helicopter crash, then we'll talk.
Oh, oh geez, Jesus. God. Criminy.
Oh my God.
Okay, what if he does that?
He said, then we'll talk. Oh, my God. Oh, that made me uncomfortable. Right. It's not often I get uncomfortable on this show.
Ooh, I'm good sweating. Lord.
Oh, I love it when I do that right now. That's so
it is pretty hot in here.
It is melting in here.
If you all,
it is on. It is running.
Derek's just turning up the heat.
I'm very proud about that right now. I'm sorry.
It's murderous.
10 degrees lower, Brad, please.
We're going down to
6. 9 degrees lower, you mean.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Mathematically speaking, I apologize.
Denver math on air. We know that now.
Well, remember, he doesn't listen, so he wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Once again, big shout out to you, our listeners. This is FM 90.1.
Who's not Will?
KZFR Chico. People-powered community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We are talking about practice. Drew, Derek, Snapman, Brad, and our boy Will Tomasini in the building. Got to give a big shout-out to our friends over at Grub CSA Farm, offering sustainably grown local produce from their farm in Chico. Grub's weekly CSA vegetable box season has begun. To sign up for your weekly box of produce, visit GrubCSAFarm.com. Or at 680-4543. And on Facebook, Grub Produce is also available at all Chico Farmers Markets. So there you have it, people. There you have it. Oh, man. It's been a hell of a day. Hell of a weekend. While we're on the subject of it being a hell of a weekend, we got to give a shout out to our man, our brother, TVP member, woo! Jordan Booth. He and Bria got married this past weekend. TVP was in the building for that. We had a great time. Derek was the only white guy on the dance floor on numerous occasions, which was just fantastic to watch.
Doesn't shock us, though. Not one bit. You are a party animal.
I had to put it out there.
Derek learned how to wobble this weekend.
I did.
Good for you.
Yeah. I'm not going to say I'm the best at it, but I think you attempted, and that's what counts.
I put
it out there.
Yeah, Cowboy Brad over here wore his cowboy hat and sung Let Me Love You by Mario, and that was a major hit. So shouts to you guys for bringing the life to the party.
It is my go-to jam. I know every word of that.
Appreciate you guys.
Would have never guessed that.
No. Oh, yeah, big R&B fan.
Giant.
Huge R&B fan.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah.
They were shocked, too, when they found out. They looked at me like I was crazy when I was singing it at Beach Hut.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was pretty intense. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, time for Derek Usumaki with
huge R&B fan.
The news.
When news breaks in the tri-state area or the world.
Breaking news, breaking news. Derek Usumaki has breaking news.
You never cease to amaze, bro.
I know, right?
Sorry, go ahead, Derek.
Dennis Rachel. Time for the news.
We got some. I got a couple duties for y'all right now. A couple of nice. Maybe not nice. We'll find out. You'll find out. You'll be the judge. So we head down to our neighbors of the north. Good old Mexico. I don't know if you know.
Wait, say it again? Wait, yeah. Neighbors what? Of the north is Canada.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Canada's pretty much Mexico at this point in time, so you might as well got them confused.
So it is up north?
To the south.
I'm so okay. Wait.
I was like, geographically speaking.
I'm sorry. We're going down.
If you just
down.
Keep going north, you're going to catch them
you
at
will.
One point.
There we go. See, that's a man who knows.
You're still wrong, but the world goes. If you keep going up north, you're going to end up.
Henry said the earth is flat, dude. So
there you go. See?
Yeah, well, he's got a point.
So, got me.
Proved.
You got
proven.
Me.
Yeah.
So again, I'm sorry. We're going down south, y'all, to our good old neighbors down in Mexico. Not enough, you know. They have a lot of drug cartels in Mexico.
What?
They like their drugs down there.
No.
They like their drugs, they like their cartels. And you know what those cartel members like? They like their exotic animals.
Oh, yeah.
They love their exotic animals, you know? I mean, Pablo Escobar is known for his hippos. The Pablo Escobar hippos in Colombia have taken over that said area in Medellin. Because of Pablo Escobar, and they can't get rid of him now. They're doing damages to the whole
ecosystem.
You can't.
However, the locals have all learned to love and adopt those hippos, so they can't get rid of them.
Wait, they adopted them?
Well, who's going to stop them? Have you ever seen one?
Well, I knew that, but I didn't know they adopted them.
Well, they're part of the community right now. They're not. We love these hippos. We care for them. They're in our. Yeah.
Yeah, they have the same.
Yeah, they all sleep in the same house together. They all come back home. They all feed them.
I thought they went to the market and whatnot, and like
they use them as
a hippo just eating a watermelon.
He's just sitting there eating a watermelon. Hey, Frank, how's it going?
So either way,
hungry hippos.
We're no longer in Colombia. Again, we're moving no more up north. We're going to Mexico. Like I said, these Mexican cartel gangbangers, they love their exotic animals.
Gangbangers. Are we sure it's up north? Are we sure?
Up,
I just want to make
Colombia,
sure.
We go north
okay.
to Mexico.
I just want to make sure we're okay.
All right?
Okay.
Yeah. Gangbangers. So we head over.
You sound like an old disgruntled white man at a country club. We open up the borders. Next thing you know, we bring in all those gangbangers from Mexico.
I say that because they put these exotic animals in bad situations.
All right,
so
go
these
ahead,
are gangbangers right now. Okay. These are bad dudes right now. So we go into the area of Xicaliente right now. So, look alive, y'all, where a shootout happened amongst one of these Mexican cartels. Now, in one of those cartels, they had a monkey with them. Now, on that monkey, they put a bulletproof vest on said monkey. It's a little spider monkey. Spider monkey's got a bulletproof vest on. He's ready to strap up.
Where do you find a vest that small?
With that type of money, you can make anything custom. You know?
That's fair.
Okay. No. Damn gangbangers.
Unfortunately for said spider monkey, that he didn't really help him. Yeah. Said bulletproof vest failed said monkey. And said spider monkey died. But said spider monkey looked hard when he died because he had a vest on. Spider monkey with a vest. A bulletproof vest.
Did he get shot by a bullet?
He did, yes.
No.
Yeah.
Dang.
That's how it was.
I just want to make sure.
A shootout, A shootout took out our lovely spider monkey in a bulletproof vest. I would say maybe put him in a bulletproof body armor then. Maybe the whole body gets covered next time. That's what you should get.
Or maybe put on one of those like bulletproof glass chambers like the Pope is in or something.
Yeah, that's what you should do. That would be probably the best way to maintain said exotic animals around. Now, in said shootout right now that was happening, we had it was a tiger on the loose as well that the officials had to corral up after the
same shootout? Scene,
at the same shootout. So we got tigers and monkeys.
This is a wild shootout.
This might as well have been in the heart of India right now or something, you know? with all these exotic animals with Indians and tigers. But no, it was
and
in Mexico.
Bears, oh my.
Thank you. Right? But no, this is in Mexico with them gangbangers shooting up exotic animals. So yeah, watch out, y'all, with your exotic animals. Make sure you put them in a fully enclosed capsule. when you take him out for your gunshots. You know, just think of the animals first.
R.I.P. Spider Monkey.
Now, we keep it in the drug culture right now because we've already stirred the pot right now.
Might as well. Why would we change topics?
So, there's unfortunate for some gangbangers out there who aren't going to be able to reap the rewards of all the cocaine that they have produced. Because unfortunately for them, when they're sending out their cocaine over cross seas, they like to hide it. Obviously, you can't just put cocaine on a ship and send it off away. You got to suck it in someplace. So, what do? They put it in bananas, a shipment of bananas. $83 million worth of cocaine in a shipment of bananas. However, said shipment of bananas didn't go to its right location. It went to a supermarket in the Czech Republic.
Oh, wow.
God.
So this, you check, people in Czech open up their bananas, and what do they got? $83 million worth of cocaine. So, check your bananas, y'all. You might have cocaine in there. Okay?
Chiquita bonita.
I'm just saying. I mean...
Italian speaking Spanish. Interesting.
See.
So, adios mio. And these drugs did come from our friends down south in Colombia. So a little bit north, a little
north
bit more further south. Yeah.
A little bit north further of south. The Colombian bug border.
Just north of Mexico. I say that facetiously. Yes, I was trying to.
Okay.
That was
a bad
joke.
Okay.
If you don't know it, you don't know your geography. It was a dumb joke. I'm sorry. I take it back. So again. Bananas, cocaine, went to the Czech, not to Germany where they're supposed to go, where $83 million of cocaine was supposed to land up, but it didn't. Ended up in the Czech, and now they got a lot of cocaine there. Maybe they'll help them defeat the Russians now. Wait, they're in Ukraine. Never mind. I take it back. Wrong country. Either way, maybe send that money to Ukraine.
Did you just
Ukraine.
Say about geography?
Yeah,
your didn't geog- you just say
I'm
geography
all over the place right
rough
now.
Today?
It's been rough in one occasion. I just mistaken
multiple
one country
occasions.
For one for another. Czech, Ukraine. All right, tomato, potato. The same thing, okay? I think they really are. They're all middle European.
I mean, he also did
okay?
say
they're
Russian,
all the
Ukraine
same,
are the
white
same.
People. They all probably talk very similar languages with like a slightly different tone to it. And yes, I'm being very racist against Europeans, though. Europeans,
yeah, I hear
white
you.
People.
Well, actually,
totally
they're
fine.
More Asia than anything.
No, they're not. They're in Europe.
Ukraine's Europe?
Wow.
100%, dude.
Wrong.
I thought that was further. I thought they were part of the... Oh.
They're in Eastern Europe.
That's Europe.
Okay.
But they're Europe still.
Okay.
Yeah.
This might be the dumbest show we've ever done. But
oh, I don't think so, but it's up there.
That's fair.
I feel like we've had dumber.
It's definitely up there. But still. So careful, y'all. Check your bananas. You might have cocaine in there now. Okay? So, hey, you might get lucky. Go for some potassium, and then you get high. That's the news, y'all.
Got a cramp, and then cure that with some energy.
Yeah, I think that was
important. I'm pretty sure you won't get no cramps.
Okay. You ready for...
Let's bring on our foreign correspondent.
Save the show, please.
All right.
We're getting off the rails.
So each week we bring in our foreign correspondent south of the border. Aaron, to spice up the show, bring some class to the show. Aaron, how we doing?
How's it going, guys?
Yes.
Well, I'm doing fantastic because the Warriors won, and I'm guessing you're doing pretty all right now because
Boston didn't win, so I'm not too upset.
Yeah, I figured. And your Avs just blew out the Lightning the other night, 7-0. When I looked up at the score, I was like, what? 7-0. So your Avs are rolling against the two-time defending champs and the Tampa Bay Lightning. So let's do a quick hockey update.
Fuck yeah!
Yeah, 7-0 on Saturday night. It was wild. I couldn't believe it. Their first goal came within the first 2 minutes. Their second goal came within the first, I think, 6 minutes. It was during a power play. But again, if you're up 2-0 within the first 10 minutes, you're not upset about that. They did end up winning 7-0. They did score one of their goals during Tampa's power play. A Tampa power play, they scored a goal. I think that's the most impressive. It's a little strange, though, because game one went into overtime. Also, they just scored. Did they just score? They just scored, guys. They just scored. You're hearing it live. Avalanche have just scored. They did score earlier, and it was, Tampa challenge. It didn't go, but the Avalanche have just scored, 11:41 to go in the first. This is incredible. This is really exciting.
Good, like, live updates right there for you.
Really
guys.
Is.
You're welcome, listeners.
Guys, they just scored. This is awesome. Yeah, so they're looking really good. I feel really bad. I don't want to jinx it, but they might win in less than six games.
No kidding. Yeah, they.
Yeah,
it's looking good. It's pretty crazy. On the topic of shorthanded goals, the Edmonton Oilers had three in this postseason, which is gives them the lead as far as most shorthanded goals in the Stanley Cup playoffs in the history of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Wow. That's got to be really impressive. Like, a great feeling as a player. If you get a shorthanded goal, that's probably one of the best feelings in hockey. I don't know. I mean, I don't play hockey. I got to feel great.
It has to.
That comes from StatMuse. I highly recommend StatMuse. They have some amazing stats. But anyway, your app's looking great. So congratulations.
Yeah, it's very exciting, Drew. I would like to thank you because you were the one that allowed me to be an Avalanche fan. Some people have criticized me, but I still cite your rule. I feel really good about it. I appreciate you. Thank you so much. I do owe it to you. And I owe it to you. It's, I got to give it up to you.
Well, thank you. Anything to help you out here? And no, we're on the same page. You moved. It's okay to relocate your teams. I'm with you. So let's talk some U.S. Open because holy hell, did we have
holy moly.
Sunday was interesting. Matter of fact, hold on real quick while I have you here. I feel like this might be necessary, and maybe you could fill me on this because this has been driving me nuts watching golf yesterday.
You know what really grinds my gears?
When they do the shot of the golf ball in the air from the ground and all you could see is sky and clouds and a golf ball. You have no idea where that ball is going. It's 2022. We have drones. We have helicopters. Why is that the shot we're still doing? Every time they tee off and it's just a ball in midair, I have no idea if it's going in the stands, in the water, if it's going to hit the sand, or if it's going to land 3 inches from the cup. We have no idea. Why are we still filming golf this way? It drives me nuts.
I'm with you on that.
I do feel you, but I think it also is a great way to kind of like level the playing field, right? These guys working the cameras, the
it's
best
insane.
At their game, top
so
tier,
good.
And
so
they don't know
good.
Where the ball went. Like, that's how like hard golf is, right? The best in the game, we don't know where their balls go. Neither
so
do the
true.
Camera guys. So I think it's really great when that happens. I go, oh, same, me too. And it makes me feel so much better because I'm like, professional golfers don't even know where their ball went.
Yes.
I don't even know where the ball goes when I'm watching my husband play golf. Like, I feel like I'm in much better company. So that's how I view it.
Absolutely. So tell us about Sunday, because Sunday was nuts with Scottie Scheffler starting the day off with the lead. What was he? He started the day 5 or 6 under par, is that correct?
Yeah, he wasn't actually in the final two. It was Will Zalatoris and Matt Fitzpatrick. Scheffler was in the second two with John Rahm. I want to talk about this course a tiny bit. This course was wild, absolutely wild. These greens were huge.
Yes.
They had hills and valleys. Some of the greens were literally S-shaped. I mean,
yes.
the fairways. Some of the fairways were absolutely S-shaped. Some of them had these crazy hills that they had to shoot straight up. Some of them had these crazy valleys that you had to hit straight over. This course in Brookline, Massachusetts was crazy. I loved it so much. It was really cool. Also, at one point, the announcers did make note that Boston had just lost, and it really... just spoke to my soul. I really appreciated
so
that.
So good. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. It really made me feel great.
Speaking of the difficulty of this course, the pin placement was insane. And that Scottie Scheffler chip that rolled back down past him about 60 yards.
I loved it so much.
Was incredible.
Also, he wasn't the only one. It wasn't the first time over the weekend. You saw it multiple times. These professional golfers would putt or chip, and it would literally just roll back right to where they started.
Yeah.
That happened to John Rahm on hole 18. He was up one. He was 5 under. I think the next person was 4 under. He was up on the going into the 18th, and then he double bogeyed, did that exact thing. He hit it into a bunker, And then when he tried to chip out of it, it rolled exactly back to where he'd originally had it. He chips out of it, hits into another bunker. So he goes in to the final day where he's the defending champ. He won last year. He goes 2 under rather than ahead 1. So again, it was Matt Fitzpatrick and Will Zalatoris. Scotty Scheffler was also in it. It was back and forth all day. It was really an exciting day of golf. But the final hole, Fitzpatrick was leading by 1. He was 6 under. Off the tee on 18, he hit it into a bunker, and it was not pretty. You were very concerned. Zalatoris was 1 back. He hit it onto the fairway. He had a great look from the green. Both of them hit it onto the green, and so Zalatoris has a chance. They hit it almost into the exact same place, a couple feet apart. Zalatoris has to birdie in order to win it, though, and he misses the birdie by, I think, less than a centimeter. Yeah. I don't know if anyone saw it, but...
Yeah. It was heartbreaking.
Brutal.
Such a brutal way to go down.
Yeah. Yeah, it was brutal. But, again, a really exciting day of golf. Fitzpatrick, his brother, was able to fly in the night before and got to see him, and just a really exciting day of golf. I loved it.
Aaron, excellent as always. We'll catch up with you next week. And hey, by then, your team might be Stanley Cup champs. So
let's not jinx it, but I'm feeling good.
I love it. All right, Aaron, thank you. Excellent as always. We'll catch up with you then.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Tiger's not back.
Yeah, never is.
I love how she just sideswipes John every opportunity she has. It's so good.
It's beautiful.
You have to bounce in just like a couple minutes here.
No, I'm good.
Oh, you're chilling.
I'm good, yeah.
Oh.
We're chilling, baby.
Well, then we'll save the Grinds My Gears for the end of the show. End on a light note. I was going to do a whole player haters ball. I'm going to keep it brief. So, actually, no. Let's knock it out. We have a minute here, right? Yeah, we got what, 9 minutes left in the show, Brad?
Plenty of time.
All right, let's do this.
The player haters ball.
Oh, man. Hey, 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 hey. Why you wanna play hate on me?
So if you went to the bank today, you might have noticed they were closed. In recognition of Juneteenth. Juneteenth was a celebration, or is a celebration, of the end of slavery started in Galveston, Texas. And now banks decided they're going to take the day off. Which is hilarious and also very troubling if you think about the fact that, aside from slavery, banks have definitely had their fair share in their hand of dealing black folks a raw deal. What do I mean by that? In the 1930s, redlining was created to only allow black folks to get home loans in certain areas, essentially creating your first ghettos in America. Well, that all changed with the Fair Housing Act in 1968, one would think, right? Wrong! And in 2020, Wells Fargo came under fire after 60% of black folks that qualified as far as credit, income, and all of the qualifications one would need to purchase a home were denied loans yet again because of racial discrimination. So thank God that the banks took a break today. I'm sure all these bank executives, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, all those guys are probably chilling at home just thinking about the ill will of the past, trying to do better for this country moving forward. They certainly didn't just take the day because they could. They definitely did it for all the right reasons. Am I right, guys?
Do you think they're actually doing something even on a day that wasn't a holiday? They're probably not doing anything anyway.
No, absolutely.
At the same point in time, I will say, if you want the holiday to become a real holiday, the bank's got to be closed. If you want a holiday to be true, a bank has to be closed on that day.
And also, can we stop with all this solemnness on Juneteenth? Listen, Juneteenth is supposed to be a celebration, and it's a summer holiday. Similar to the 4th of July, it does not need to be solemn. It is a day to kick it. Any holiday during the summer is a day to kick it. It is a day to barbecue, to relax. Listen, You know what black folks aren't doing? Talking a ton about slavery on Juneteenth. We are barbecuing the same way we do on the 4th of July. You know what no one's ever done at any 4th of July gathering I've been to? Bust out the Declaration of Independence. And be like, yo, let's go over what happened to get us to this point. No, we roast barbecue or we roast hot dogs and throw on, you know, American flag swim shorts and go to the beach.
I will say, I think it's going to happen in the next coming years once there's going to be like Juneteenth sales. There's going to be all these people like, yes. Yo, Juneteenth sales right now, you know.
Half off pomade.
No. 3/5 off pomade.
Oh! Let's go.
I can't take credit for that joke because there's a great joke right now. I took it from Andrew Schultz, but still.
It's still a great joke.
That's still great.
Because you know that's going to be happening pretty soon. Once they get the holiday sales around it, banks already closed, and now we're going to get holiday deals around it.
Well, that's when we've truly reached equality in this country.
Oh, yeah.
Is when Juneteenth becomes a holiday special.
Yeah, there we go.
100%.
That's what we need to do right now. That's when the world comes together and racism's over.
I feel like...
Juneteenth is a day that Kohl's has bargains going on.
I feel like that, and you have a Hallmark special day.
There you go. A Hallmark special Juneteenth right now.
Yeah, when there's a Toyota-thon on Juneteenth... We officially reached equality in this country, guys.
Hey, we're happy Honda Days over here, okay?
Honda Days on Juneteenth. I love it.
Oh, wow.
Let's just, everyone, just relax, guys.
Yes, so, sir. So, just real quick, Tampa Bay just tied it up. It's 1-1 right now.
Right. There we go. Okay, we need the updates right now.
We do need the in-game updates.
Because we are a sports show.
I mean, we got to give Erin, got to bring her down a little bit.
Yeah.
She was getting way too hyped up. Yeah. She's like, we're winning the series now. I was like, whoa.
I know you haven't watched, Will, but we are somewhat of a sports show. So, every once in a while, we do have to talk about
sports. That's what I've been told.
Yeah. We give score updates, okay? Live score updates.
Yeah.
You got some grinds my gears for the people?
Yeah, I do have some grinds my gears.
So, again, if you're like Will and haven't listened to the show in some time, we like to burn on some things that really grind our gears. So, Derek, hit him with one.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Hold on, let me turn it up.
One more time, yeah.
My bad. Let's do it one more time. Whoops.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Gatorade's new drink. It's called Gatorade's, I don't know what it's called, but it's called Gatorade's new healthy real hydration drink. What were you giving us before? Was that not real hydration before? Now you got real hydration? So I was dehydrating myself all the other times I have a Gatorade until this new drink came out? Like, what were you doing beforehand right now, Gatorade? I get it. You're not the healthiest of drinks out there, but you are one of the most delicious in my times of need. In my times of need, I go to Gatorade to get hydrated. Now, I wasn't getting hydrated at all. Now I get the real hydration. What were you doing before, Gatorade? That's what I want to know. What was before the real hydration? Fake hydration?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Can I do one real quick along the same lines?
Yeah. You know what really grinds my gears?
There's a hangover recovery drink called Morning Recovery that you're supposed to drink the night before when you're drinking. If I had remembered to drink that, don't you think I could have just drank water?
Why do you call it Morning Recovery?
Shouldn't you call it night?
Day of recovery.
Yeah.
Night of recovery.
Yeah.
Drink while you're drinking recovery.
Yes. Agreed. You got another one?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Baby on board stickers on cars.
Oh, my God.
Like, what are you trying to tell me? Oh, I'm not going to hit this person right now because I got a baby on board. I'm going to swerve over this way now.
That's actually for the paramedics and the firefighters.
I don't want your logic right now.
Yeah.
But even then, why do they need to know whether a baby's in there or not? I want to be treated the same way.
The car's on fire. I was going to save them. Now,
baby on there. Now I'm going for sure.
To go after the baby first.
Okay.
I
hate your logic. I don't want to know there's a baby on board.
Agreed.
For everyone else, I get the people that matter. Save the baby first. Because, the person has a baby.
Yeah.
Save the baby. I got one more,
You know what really grinds my gears?
The guy that listens to his music so loud when he drives past your house, that it rattles at your windows.
Yeah.
I get it. You want to bump. You got your vibe. You got a great song on. But I don't want to hear it. I'm not in the car with you. And when I hear everything that's going on, and my windows are rattling because you're driving down so slowly, just like trying to soak it all in. No. Yes, selfish. See you next Tuesday. Don't ever do that again to me right now. Turn it down. Turn the bass down or something a little bit. Like, what are you trying to do? We don't need to show off. You have 215s in the back of your car. That was 2005, okay?
Rock for Foskes. Not there anymore.
Yeah, rattle the trunk. Y'all remember popping off the faceplate, put it in the little pouch, and walking around the mall with your faceplate in your pocket?
Drive slow, homie.
What?
I wish there was you'd a permanently... have to, Brad, you have to used to take off your CD faceplate. If not, your stuff will get stolen.
Yep.
Yeah, I know. I'm blowing your mind away. Right
what?
Now. Yeah, this was.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
I do not remember these
without
times.
That faceplate was nothing.
I mean, I get it. I'm the youngest guy in the room, but I didn't feel like I was that young.
Oh yeah,
did you guys have yours stolen out? One of ours got stolen out of our car.
No, yeah. I never did.
Smashed in a window. It's just such a.
I had one 10 in my Jeep, and someone took my 10.
Yeah. Oh, that's rough. Yeah. But good old 2005 years, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're welcome, Brad.
Wow.
You look shocked.
Yeah. I am beyond shocked.
Now everyone.
So you used to have this thing also that was called a phone booth.
Right? Oh. That's going to do it for us. Catch us next week. We will be back. We're going to take a break on the 4th, but you catch us next week. And listen, this is the best time of the year for talking about practice because there's almost no sports. We're going to be baseball heavy. Brad's not even watching baseball. So
I hate this.
Fix baseball again. What are our typical tropes this time of year?
I mean, you're going to get a lot of crazy. Like, more of me being going down stupid rabbit holes.
Yeah. All right.
Well, a lot of rabbit holes.
Derek going down rabbit holes for the next 2 months. So look forward to that. It's been real, y'all. Peace.
Game over, man. It's game over.
Next up, counter spin.
Ugh. Here it goes.
I don't. Yeah.
Here's counter spin.
DJ spin. Uh-oh. That. I don't know.
2-1 lightning. What?
Oh my gosh. 2-1 lightning.
Oh, man, you ruined it.
Well, right now, before we go to counter spin, it's 2-1 lightning with 4:09 left in the first period. Well, I don't know how this is going to go for Aaron, but I don't know. We'll see how counter spin
here's
goes.
Here goes counter spin. Yay.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the New York Times evidently didn't address the brutal 1982 murder of Chinese-American Vincent Chin until 1983 in response to ongoing protest centered in Detroit's Asian-American community about the killing and the lack of justice, at which point the Times ran a story with a lead claiming that when two men were quickly charged and prosecuted, the incident faded from many memories. Well, one, the process was hardly that tidy, and two, whose memories exactly? It's 40 years since Vincent Chin's murder, with a depressingly resonant context of anti-Asian hatred and scapegoating that corporate media, with their thinly veiled drumbeat for war with China over trade or COVID or presence in Africa, do little to dissuade. We'll talk with activist and author Helen Zia about the ongoing effort to remember Chin's murder by rededicating to the work of resisting not just anti-Chinese or anti-Asian ideas and actions, but also those separating us each from one another in the fight against those who, let's face it, hate all of us. Also on the show, we're told not to overanalyze, which seems to mean to analyze at all, the language of reporting, and not to think too much about what's behind the scenes. It's official news from a neutral nowhere. But if the New York Times, for example, has enough intentionality to delete without acknowledgement declarative claims about rising crime, in an article about how concerns about crime are moving people to vote out reformist officials, like San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, well, can we not imagine that they are likewise intentional about what they leave in? We'll talk about coverage of Chesa Boudin's recall, of which elite media are making much conventional wisdom hay, with Alec Karakatsanis, founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, and author of the book Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair. Vincent Chin was beaten to death in Detroit in June 1982 by two white auto workers who reportedly said it was because of him that they had lost their jobs. At the time, listeners may recall, Japan was being widely blamed for the collapse of the Detroit auto industry. Chin was Chinese American. Elite media, as reflected by the New York Times, didn't seem to come round to the story until April 1983, with reporting on the protests emanating from Detroit's Asian American community about the dismissive legal response to the murder. Chin's killers, Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz, were given probation and fines, with Wayne County Circuit Court Judge Charles Kaufman infamously saying they, quote, weren't the kind of people you send to jail, close quote. It took protest for big media to attend to that legal perversity and the broader context of anti-Asian hatred and scapegoating. And it's civil rights activism that has been the legacy of Chin's death 40 years ago this week, activism of which our guest is a key part. Helen Zia is co-founder of American Citizens for Justice and author of Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, among other titles. She joins us now by phone from Detroit. Welcome back to Counterspin, Helen Zia.
Well, it's my honor to be with you, Janine.
I saw you speak recently in Detroit and say that Vincent Chin's horrific murder, its circumstances, and then the legal failures are all extremely important, but that that's not the whole story that's being acknowledged right now with this 40th remembrance and rededication. The story of Vincent Chin's killing is also about what came after, what grew from it. Can you talk a little about what that was and is?
Oh, absolutely. It was a horrific killing. And not only that, but a continued miscarriage of justice where the justice system failed at every turn for a young man who was killed and attacked on the night of his bachelor party because of how he looked at a time of intense anti-Asian hate. And all of that was very important. It brought attention to the whole idea that Asian Americans are people, that we are humans, that we are Americans, and that we experience racism and discrimination. But that's not all that was important, because that event and the miscarriage of justice catalyzed a whole movement, a civil rights movement led by Asian Americans, with Detroit, Michigan as the epicenter of that civil rights movement that reached all across America for Asian Americans and also had a huge impact on really democracy in this country and in many, many different ways. And it represented the solidarity of people from all walks of life. We were in Detroit, now a majority black city, back then was a majority black city, and we had incredible support from the black community, as well as Arab American community, multi-faith, multi-class, people from all walks of life, not only in Detroit, and then as it became a national movement, really sparked a discussion and a movement that took the moment of the killing of Vincent Chin and then the injustice that followed, but turned it into a civil rights movement, a human rights movement that has still an impact today. And that's why we're talking about this. It's to remember that moment, but the legacy as well of people coming together in solidarity, you know, with the idea that an injury to one is an injury to all, and we have a basic interest in joining together to ensure each other's safety, that we are part of a beloved community, that no community should live in fear of violence or hate. And this notion of all our communities being so divided, can we ever be allies, let alone come together? And so that's what we're remembering. Let's not forget that actually we have been in solidarity, and let's take the lessons of that and, you know, move it forward to today, because we need that desperately.
When you say remembrance and rededication, which is what this event series is about, I really like that rededication part, which has to do with acknowledging that, as you say, an injury to one is an injury to all.
And that's completely right, and that's why we are saying it's more than remembrance. It's about rededication. It's about taking the hard work that happened then. And, you know, coming together in unity and in solidarity and building a movement, there's nothing simple about that. There's no kumbaya. It really takes people working hard together to bridge understandings and undo misunderstandings, break down stereotypes, and build a common understanding and a common bond between communities. And so when, as you say, communities are portrayed in the news or in TV or whatever and in movies that, you know, this is just that community's concern. It doesn't involve other people. Anti-Asian violence, well, hey, that's just Asians, and we don't even know that they're Americans. You know, we don't even know that they ever were on this continent for, you know, several hundred years. And so I think you're right. That's a way of sort of pigeonholing people and keeping us apart instead of looking at the true commonality. You know, if we talk about Vincent Chin or violence against Asian Americans, we also talk about Buffalo and we talk about Coeur d'Alene and how ideas of white supremacy and even active white supremacist groups, they lump us together. They don't see us as separate groups. Mm-hmm. They connect the dots in a very negative way. And so it's really incumbent on all thinking people, and especially our media, to be able to connect those dots too and not keep us separate. And it isn't, you know, often I think an unconscious way of saying, well, that's this group's problem, then the other group has this problem, and never the twain should meet. And unfortunately, that's part of what on the ground we have to overcome and do that education to say, no, actually, we're all in this together. And media has such an important role to play in that if we can break through that as well.
Well, yeah, and I just wanted to add, it did seem from my looking into it that it took the protests for big media to attend to Chin's murder. But even then, some of what we saw was, here's this Times piece from September 10th, 1983, Asian Americans see growing bias, you know, and then the opening is, Asian American leaders say they are alarmed by what they regard as rising discrimination against their people. So even there, there's kind of a, maybe it's not true, you know, maybe it's just a perception. I wonder, have you seen shifts in media? You've obviously been working on this for a long time. Are there more openings now? Do you have to explain things less? Have you seen shifts in the way that media approach this set of issues?
You know, there are shifts. There has been progress. But I have to say, we still have to do that basic Asian Americans 101 all the time. So back in 1982, 83, Asian Americans were so invisibilized, you know, so minoritized that the whole country really had no concept of who Asian Americans are. So when we started first trying to raise this as an issue and have our press conferences and things like that, we were asked questions like, well, where did you all come from? Did you all just sort of land in America? More or less saying, are you all fresh off the boat? And we would have to say, well, many Asian Americans are immigrants, but actually we have been also on this continent for hundreds of years, fighting in the Civil War, having records that go back to the 1500s in the Spanish archives of Mexico and, quote, New Spain of that time. And it was all about an education to say, you know what, we are not this foreign invader that just landed here. And that's what we had to do over and over again. You know, questions like, do you all speak English? And you would just have to say, what do you think I'm speaking with you now? And then, why do you speak such good English? And I'd have to answer it more grammatically and say, well, I speak English well because I was born and raised here. And yes, we've progressed from that time. But unfortunately, even we see in this terrible pandemic, the dual pandemic of COVID and hate, you know, that includes the anti-Asian hate that's been going on. When those were first reported by people who were attacked in different incidents and they put it on social media, the first response overall was, wow, this happens to Asian Americans?
Right.
Well, who knew that?
Yeah.
You know, it was more surprise and eye-opening. And so that was, in a way, the news. And we see that not being challenged by media when, for example, in Atlanta, 8 people were killed as a killer went in search of Asian Americans and killed 6 Asian women who were working. And the police immediately say, oh, this has nothing to do with race. And we don't see the pushback on that, querying that. It's sort of like it's almost accepted until now what makes a difference is the communities, the grassroots, the people on the ground saying, hey, what do you mean? This has everything to do with race. It has everything to do with gender and how Asian Americans are viewed. So the difference is that there's more of a voice, there's more of a community and organizations that actually can correct feelings or just where the ball is dropped and the questions that should be asked or followed up on aren't. So that's a difference. But maybe we have to explain a little less, but really we have to explain over and over again. And to your point about this being seen as, well, it's just an Asian American issue, part of the teaching constantly has to be, no, this is really connected. Hate crimes are connected. The Vincent Chin case had a big role to play in the Hate Crimes Protection Act that was signed in 2010 by President Obama that also included gender and sexual orientation and disability. Well, the broadening of the concept of civil rights and who's protected really was argued in 1983 by Asian Americans to say that immigrants and Asian Americans should be protected by federal civil rights law, because that was not a given. There were a lot of racism deniers back then and even today, so that unfortunately we do have to counter kind of the same misconceptions that existed then and today. The fight and the education never end.
We've been speaking with Helen Zia, co-founder of American Citizens for Justice. You can learn about the 40th Remembrance and Rededication at vincentchin.org. Thank you so much, Helen Zia, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. Thank you and FAIR for all the work you do.
Politico, in a not stupid piece on the ultimately successful recall campaign against San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudine, referred offhandedly to Republicans across the country running on public safety. Quote, betting voters will punish Democrats for embracing a more lenient approach to sentencing and incarceration, close quote. In reality, the work of decarceration, as understood by people who've been studying and advocating and doing it for decades, involves deep engagement with communities and their human needs. It's nothing less than an intentional, accountable reprioritization of social resources. It is emphatically not doing less, which is what is implied by the term leniency. That kind of apparently lazy but very meaningful misrepresentation in a phrase, writ larger, is the media coverage of Chesa Boudine's recall, coverage that our guest has been monitoring and breaking down on Twitter and elsewhere. Alec Karakatsanis is founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, a civil rights lawyer and public defender. He's author of the book Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alec Karakatsanis.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much.
Everyone knows somebody who argues by only mentioning information that supports their point of view and obscuring rather than engaging any that doesn't, no matter how germane. It's an obnoxious, regressive way to have a conversation, but it's something worse when you pretend it's journalism. So I'd like to have you talk us through the problems with this June 8th New York Times article, but maybe just start by saying why you chose to take it up. We see crap crime coverage every day. Why did this stand out to you?
I think elections are a particular moment of consciousness where people are paying attention more than they ordinarily would to political punditry, to commentary, to articles about policy. And so I think it was a particularly important moment, you know, at 5 a.m. the morning after the election when the New York Times put this article online. And based on the placement the Times gave it in various of its platforms, is estimated by the sort of analytics tracking company Meltwater to have had the potential reach of 170 million people. So for me, it was a very prominent and very important article, which the New York Times pitched as its main takeaways from last Tuesday's elections. And so for that reason, I thought it was profoundly troubling that the Times created such a dishonest and dangerous narrative that what the voters were somehow telling us is that we need to double back down on mass incarceration policies that by every conceivable available metric have been an utter failure as a matter of keeping us safe and a disaster as a matter of human rights and basic human dignity.
So how did this story do that? What were the sort of mechanisms in the story itself that pushed that conclusion?
If we had 10 hours, we couldn't cover them all, but I'll do my best.
I know.
Virtually every word and clause in the article was an effort designed to concoct out of nowhere a false narrative that the election was a victory for tough-on-crime right-wing policies. So the first problem with the article is, who is it relying on? Who pitched it? How did it get there and why, right? I think the second and most glaring problem that I lead with in my analysis of the article is that it bases its entire thesis that voters are sending a tough-on-crime message on just two races, the mayor's race in Los Angeles and the DA recall in San Francisco. In order to do that, the article had to ignore the vast majority of elections in California and across the country. And if you look at the other elections in California on these issues, progressive candidates trounced their opponents. The following races were completely and utterly ignored by the New York Times. The California Attorney General's race, where a progressive reformer absolutely trounced the tough-on-crime opponent who everyone had been talking about and boosting prior to the election. She ended up coming in like fourth place. Tiny percentage of the vote trounced by the progressive California reforming Attorney General. Same thing with Contra Costa, Alameda. If you look at the local races in Los Angeles, while the Times gives almost the entire article to boosting Rick Caruso, the Republican, former Republican billionaire, a real estate developer, as more results have come in the days since the election, he actually is now losing. And Karen Bass is beating him, which is the entire thrust of the Times article. And if you look at the other local races, a citywide race for controller was a referendum on police budget. And the progressive candidate, Kenneth Mejia, trounced the longtime multiple incumbent city council person. And Mejia ran a transparent, clear, effective campaign about very popular things, investing in our safety through schools, housing, healthcare, treatment, rather than more and more cash for surveillance technology and overtime. And these are very popular positions, it turns out. And the Times just ignored all of that, as well as a number of other LA city council races. I'll just pause there because I think I want people to understand that the entire framing of the article was based on two examples, one of which has now turned out to be utterly false in terms of like the local Los Angeles mayor's race, where the very basis of their narrative that this former Republican billionaire had won is now incorrect as more votes have been counted. But two, it all relied on ignoring these other races.
Right. And that selective storytelling amounts to an important misrepresentation and then misdirection. And just to tease out one thing that you've said, the focus on elections often leads media to talk about people and individuals and to ignore the voters and the public. And what you have indicated repeatedly is that the policies, these policies about engaging the criminal justice system, about reprioritization, these are popular policies. And if the media were genuinely interested in being the people's voice, then even if a particular candidate lost, they would still be engaged with whether the particular policies and ideas were well received and popular with the people.
Absolutely. This is another key point. So if you look at the New York Times article, it claims that voters were motivated by what it called unchecked property crime in San Francisco. If you look at the actual data from San Francisco police themselves, property crime is significantly down under the tenure of the current DA. So is violent crime, way down in San Francisco. By every conceivable metric on which every local prosecutor and police budget and set of policies are measured, the tenure of this progressive DA was an enormous success. What the Times ignores is there was a huge $7 million effort led by Republican billionaires and the police union to tarnish the DA himself. And much of that was based on complete fabrications, total misinformation, lies, but a very, very active local media effort. Another tech venture capitalist rich person hired an entire media outlet and a full-time reporter to just boost these right-wing lies in San Francisco itself, and the kind of resources that are hardly ever thrown at local journalism anymore. It was really incredible to watch. All of that was ignored by the Times, and instead, they tried to make it look like the voters were rejecting Boudin's policies. But if you actually look at the available polling that we have for voters in San Francisco, every single one of Boudin's major policy priorities were enormously popular with the voters. This is a really interesting story that the Times just completely ignores because it does not fit its narrative that voters don't want progressive policy.
Here's a bit from the Times piece. Quote, California called for order. Racked by pandemic, littered with tent camps, frightened by smash-and-grab robberies and anti-Asian hate crimes, voters in two of the most progressive cities sent a message on Tuesday, restore stability, close quote. There is a breathtaking amount of work being done there. The definition of stability, poverty is a crime, sickness somehow is also a crime, Asian Americans want a carceral response. It's so freighted, and it's just their kind of, hey, here's our conclusion, take this away, you know.
I think I want to highlight something that you said, which is incredibly important. Obviously, there's so much misinformation and propaganda in there. But one thing in particular stands out, and there was a few other moments in the Times coverage where it was a little bit more explicit about this, but essentially what the Times is saying is that there is a trade-off between what it calls order and stability mm-hmm. and civil rights or humane treatment of people in the criminal system, and that by being more quote-unquote lenient, we actually lead to less stability and order. This is the core flaw and what I call propaganda element at the center of so much New York Times reporting. And I think the reason is that there is a scientific consensus. What the Times is doing is like, is violating that scientific consensus as if the Times were saying that climate change is not happening. There is a scientific consensus that the solution to problems of drug use and mental illness and homelessness and the low-level behavior and activity at the Times is sort of referring to when it talks about disorder, there's a consensus that you do not solve those problems through more police, prosecutors, and prisons. Those problems must be solved through investments in medical care and treatment and mental health treatment and affordable housing and places to live and investment in schools. One of the most robust findings in the scientific literature is that investment in early childhood education and schools and teachers actually reduces all forms of crime years into the future. We know all of these things. What the Times is trying to do is tell people you have to choose between respecting people's rights and treating them leniently and safety. And this is false because the only way we're going to get to real safety in our society, the way that every other comparably wealthy country has achieved much higher levels of safety and lower levels of violence, is by actually investing in the things that lead to safety. There's one other thing that I want to point out, which I think is very important. The Times suggests that the voters and the politicians who are pursuing progressive policies somehow don't care about safety. They say, quote, some voters are foremost demanding action on systemic disparities, while others are focused on their own sense of safety in their homes and neighborhoods, end quote. So this says some people care about social justice, while other people care about safety. That is absurd. Does anyone seriously believe that the millions of poor people, black people, young people, immigrants, teachers, nurses, public health experts, faith leaders, crime survivors, who've been fighting against systemic injustice and inequality in their community, they don't care about the safety also of their neighborhoods? That is just such a false dichotomy, and it's so prevalent in reporting from the New York Times over the last couple of years.
We've been speaking with Alec Karakatsanis of Civil Rights Corps. The book, Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System, is out now from the New Press. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, a certain little corner of the public discourse this week, on and offline, was devoted to a rather arcane question, you might say, a question about sentience.